Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth, straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden. I'm working at...
An Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage, as parents, for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Hey, it's Mark. Chuck and Julie taking half the week off, which is great for them. They need to be taking some time off. As much as I love watching them every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I love that they have an opportunity right before Christmas to take time off and spend with their family. So this is Mark Poff, your old retired detective from El Paso County, going to fill in today, and we're going to talk about a lot of cool things. At first, I'm going to talk about some current events, something that actually just happened a little while ago, which I thought was kind of funny. And then I'm going to talk about January 6th. And I'm sure that you've heard a whole bunch about January 6th, but I'm going to give a little different perspective on that, more from a facts-based, what the government is doing to go after and track citizens, some of which are not being accused of any crimes, but they're getting caught up in their big net of collecting data on individuals. And I'm going to talk about some technology and show you some things and talk about a lot of the cool technology stuff. And then hopefully about 3:30, my old partner, or not old partner, my current partner in crime, we do a lot of work together. We work mainly for defense attorneys now, working with technology and stuff on criminal and civil cases. He's more of an expert on homicides and things like that, where I'm more of an expert on technology. But he was actually retained by the Ramseys to investigate into JonBenet's murder, to be very clear about it. And he's kind of been holding on to a lot of information. He worked with Lou Smith and a bunch of others, if you know them, who actually were retained because the Boulder PD totally botched the investigation. So we're going to have a little conversation. We're going to talk a little bit, if we have time, about Kim Potter. We all know that the verdict came in yesterday. Obviously, I have some opinions on that, being a retired cop. We might, if we have time, Ethan Crumbly. I don't think we're going to, about the kid with the shooting up in Michigan a little bit. And if we have time, who knows, maybe even the truck driver. We can chat about that for a little bit. But first, I want to talk about current events, which is why I have this backdrop. And I'm going to change my backdrop a couple times. In fact, I should have got that set up ahead of time. There, we got that set up. You're going to see me looking off to the right for my technology and stuff. When I'm explaining some things, I'm going to try to make sure that I talk and explain things in such a way that if you're listening in on just a podcast and you can't see my backdrop, you'll still understand what I'm talking about. But the first thing is, just a little while ago, you know, I was looking on Fox News, and I guess Joe Biden, and I don't know all the background, nor do I want to know the background, because I really don't want to know too much about what Joe Biden's doing, because all he's doing is screwing everything up. But I guess he took some phone calls with some people for Christmas Eve. And at the end of one of the conversations with the individual he was talking with, the guy actually says, "Let's go, Brandon." And Biden says something like, "Yes," or "I agree." I think he said, "I agree." So even Biden knows he's screwing up the whole nation, and everybody's fed up with him, and he's just screwing everything. And I have to love it. And I've talked about this a few times in the past, to where it's like all these people want to rush to the microphone to say something stupid. And, you know, Lightfoot, I think it's Lori Lightfoot from Chicago, blaming the businesses for not hiring their own security. I mean, just stupid statements. Well, Jen Psaki earlier this week said that the Biden administration saved Christmas. You know, we saved Christmas. And I was like, that could be about the stupidest thing ever said on a microphone in a press conference. Because if you're the one who steals all the presents, and you're the one that comes into my house and totally destroys my house or cause all this havoc, and then you come in and decide later on, you know, hey, I'm going to give you some of your stuff back, or I'm going to, you know, I destroyed your house, but I'll build you a shed that you can live in, and then say, you know, I fixed Christmas. It's like the Grinch, you know, the Grinch who stole Christmas. He comes down and he steals everything, and then he gives it back. Did he save Christmas? I don't think so. And so I just thought that was such an incredibly stupid statement on her part. And last night, I had to get in my vehicle around 11 o'clock last night and drive to the Denver airport to pick up my wife and two boys because their plane trip back from Vegas got canceled going into Colorado Springs. So my wife very quickly got on a flight to Denver. So I had to drive up to Denver last night around midnight to pick her up. You know, things are crazy right now and they're getting worse. And what the administration's doing is just saying, oh no, it's okay. It's okay. Don't worry about it. Everything's fine. You know, there's no issues. Well, let me tell you, things are really getting in bad shapes. And you know, all the isolation and stuff, it's causing so much more harm than I think this pandemic ever will, which is pretty much coming to an end. And now they're telling us that they want to live in this environment of zero risk. Well, every time I step outside, as soon as this podcast is over, I'm going to get in my kid's car and I'm going to drive to the People's Republic of Boulder for Christmas because that's where my in-laws live. And, you know, it's going to be high risk getting in that car. There is no such thing as zero risk. And, you know, to say that we're doing all these things to save people is just incredibly stupid. So that's kind of my current events thing. I really want to get into this January 6th thing because I was doing this presentation and talking about technology that the government is using to try to track down suspects in major crimes. And two of these things that I'm very familiar with were used during January 6th or during the January 6th investigation. And I got this document. And if you want, I think you definitely can't really see it because I'm using this virtual background, so it makes it hard to see. But this document is great. And if you Google January 6th discovery memo, you will see this document that I'm referring to during all of this. They're using these technologies to track people down. And what they're doing is they're casting such a wide net. Here, I want to make sure I do this. Oh, see, I went to the wrong one. Don't look at my background screen right now. There we go. That's the one that I want right now. Is, you know, we're talking about what happened at the Capitol building. And it's interesting when you read this document, and this document is talking about discovery, the challenges of discovery. I think it's one of the defendants asked for an update on discovery. So they provided this document, which became public. And there's some really interesting statements that are in here. And one of them is they talk about the scope of the investigation. And I got to read this to you. The investigation and prosecution of the Capitol breach, they want to call it the breach instead of trespass, will be the largest in American history. It doesn't say is the largest investigation in American. It will be the largest in American history. So they're already anticipating. This came out in July of the last year. So it was about 6 months after the event. And they're saying, you know, we already recognize this is going to be the largest investigation in American history, both in terms of number of defendants prosecuted and the nature of the volume of the evidence. In the 6 months since the Capitol was breached, over 500 individuals located throughout the nation have been charged with multiple crimes. And I'm not going to go through them all. The last one might apply the best, trespass. And the investigations, this is another phrase I thought was really interesting. This is the FBI. This is from the FBI. So they're investigating this. It says, there are investigations open in 55 of the Federal Bureau of Investigation's 56 field offices. So, you know, I'd want to work in the 56 because I wouldn't be interested in even dealing with this. So pretty much the FBI is doing an all hands on deck for this investigation. And then they make a statement right after that, which I just love. I can't even say this. Voluminous materials accumulated, which means a lot. It just means a lot of evidence. So they're talking about all this evidence that they collected. And I think you'd really be interested in seeing this. I'm not going to go through each one of them. Obviously, there's tons of videos and other stuff. But there's two things that really came. I don't think you can. Well, you definitely can't see it. There's two items that I really locked onto because of my experience using cellular technology and social media and other things like that, being an expert on those items. One of them is what they're saying is they gathered a lot of information around history data for thousands of devices present inside the Capitol, obtained from a variety of sources, including two geofence search warrants and searches of 10 data aggregation companies. These are ones who gather data. And I'm going to explain this whole geofence defense data that they do it. It's a common practice with law enforcement. And the other one is that they got a whole bunch of people through cellular cell tower data for thousands of devices that connected to the Capitol's interior distributed antenna system during the Capitol breach obtained from the three major telephone companies. So what they're talking about, one of them is called tower dumps. And I want to explain this to you. I'm going to hit the wrong background because I always do. Yep. Tower dumps. So let's say that we have a homicide or we have three bank robberies. Let's start with three bank robberies. And I've worked on numerous cases where I've been asked by the defense team to come in to challenge some of this information from these tower dumps. So you have three different banks that were hit, robbed at three different times. What you do is you have no suspects at all. You have no idea who committed these three armed robberies. You have no leads, nowhere to go. What you'll do is you'll say, you know, I bet you those guys who walked in had cell phones on them, or they used cell phones shortly before or shortly after those armed robberies. So they'll write warrants, generic warrants, to AT&T, Verizon, and T-Mobile. And they'll give them the location of each bank robbery at each time. And they'll say, I want you to get every possible tower that could service that area. And I want you to give me every phone call from this time to this time, 30 minutes before the event to 30 minutes after the event. Give me every phone call that was made, every text message, if you're tracking text messages. I want it all. And the vendors will do this, and they will provide it to the government. Now, they won't have the connection between the actual mobile device and who the subscriber is. It's kind of generic. So what they do is they look at the three different tower dumps, or actually it's going to be six or nine different tower dumps. They'll look at all that data and they'll put it all together. It's actually provided in such a way that you can use Excel and you can do all kinds of sorts and things like that. So you can figure out, was there any phone calls that were used between the two or three? Then once you get a phone number that matches all three, then you write another warrant to the vendor, and then they will provide you the subscriber information. So that's a great way for law enforcement to determine a suspect, to try to find a suspect. As you can imagine, if you just happen to be near a couple of these robberies and you're not doing anything that's illegal, you could be caught up and they could say, look, we have evidence, and I've seen law enforcement do this, we have evidence that places you at that armed robbery at the time of the robbery. Well, that's not true. What you have is you have tower information that shows you in a relative location near where some of these events happened. So right after January 6th, what the FBI did is they wrote tower dump warrants. And it was done with probable cause, saying that, hey, we had this event and we want to get all this information. So they got a wealth of this information that was provided to them with this tower dump information. And what makes it even more interesting is the fact that the Capitol building has its own special cellular network in it. So basically, on January 6th, if you were hitting that network, if your phone was hitting one of those towers, they pretty much concluded that you were inside the Capitol. So they gathered all this information. We're talking a lot of information. But that's not their only source of getting information. They can do another thing that's called a geofence warrant, which it says right here that they obtained the geofence search warrants. Google is the main person that's asked for this information. If you use Google Maps or Timeline or anything in Google, any app on your phone that tracks your locations, that information is all stored on their servers. iPhone stores it on the iCloud. All these apps that you're running, Life 360, Find My Friends, Facebook actually tracks locations if you have it turned on. What the government can do is they can write warrants. And according to this, they did it to 12 different sources. And they said, what we do is they actually set it up like it shows here. They set up a fence around the Capitol building. But what they don't tell you, at least in this document, is how big is that fence? Is that fence right at the size of the Capitol building? Or is it much larger because they want to get more information. Does it cover all the grassy area, you know, the land around the Capitol building? So if you happen to be at the Supreme Court building, which is behind it, or the National or Library of Congress or whatever, just happen to be in the area, will it pick you up in this geofence? We don't know how big this geofence is, but we know based on this document that based on the January 6th, that they set up these geofence warrants and they obtained all of this information. And the question is, the FBI obtained all this information via warrants. And in the Bill of Rights, it clearly says, the Fourth Amendment, that you can't get a search warrant unless it's supported by a PC affidavit, a probable cause affidavit, or by based on probable cause. So the FBI had to write this, and obviously the judges are all signing this. Now, I kept reading this document, and on page 6 of the document is something else that just really kind of, this really I found very interesting. And this is a section that they titled Recognition of Need for Vendor Promptly Addressed. This says, following the Capitol breach, the United States recognized that due to the nature and the volume of material being collected, the government would require the use of an outside contractor who could provide litigation technology support services to include highly technical and specialized data and document processing and review capabilities. So the FBI said, you know what? This is so much data that we've obtained from January 6th, just so much between the geofence warrants, and they're doing everybody's call, you know, detail records. They're getting everybody's phone records. They have all this surveillance video. They have so much data that they put out a bid to contractors to just handle the discovery collection. And also they talk about down here, undertaking review of the highest levels. Wait a minute, I didn't read the right part. They want them to help them review all this data. This is a third-party contractor. This isn't the government. This is someone that they hired who gets access to all of our data. Now, that really concerns me. Now, first off, I don't like, and this is being battled in multiple states right now, but when we talk about the tower dumps and the geofence data, the state of Massachusetts right now, it's at their Supreme Court where they're talking about the tower dumps. Because they're really getting this information with no probable cause. And let me explain. You have a crime. I do have a crime. So I'm saying I want to see every tower. I want every phone call that's made on the closest few towers to where this crime scene is. And it's becoming standard operating procedure. Like if you have a homicide in most major cities now, they will request a tower dump within a day or two. Just it, as a given, they don't even know if they have a, you know, maybe they have kind of some leads on some suspects, but this tower dump information is going to give me better information that's going to allow me to maybe establish some co-defendants or whatever. The problem is they can catch up other people. And there's been instances where other people have been tracked down. Think about it. If a detective knocked on your door and said, hey, we've got some evidence showing that you were down in this neighborhood at this date and time. And then in the background, your wife's like, you know, yeah, why would you be down in that neighborhood at that date and time? Well, you know what? It's no one's business why you're in that location at that date and time. And let's talk specifically about January 6th. Let's say that I went to see the speech of Donald Trump. I wanted to go see the speech. I flew out to Washington, D.C. I listened to a speech, and I can tell you from everything that I've seen to this point, there's nothing that Donald Trump said that in the least bit could be construed as, I want you to go riot. That didn't happen. What he said was, is march down to the Capitol and let your voice be heard. Well, that, you know, Maxine Waters has said a lot worse than that. She's talking about getting in people's faces and all kinds of things, but yet nobody brings that up. So it is completely within your right to hear your president speak. It's completely within your right to march, walk, go down to the Capitol building and be outside the Capitol building. So let's say that you do this and then you get caught up in one of these tower dumps or this geofence. And all of a sudden the government's asking you all kinds of questions. You're like, wait a minute, I'm not under investigation for any crime. I've done nothing. So how are you getting all this information on me? It's because they're doing these broad, wide net warrants, getting all kinds of cellular data and the geofencing data. And then they're all putting it into a place where they can sort it. And it's obvious right now, at least to me, that that data wants, there's people who want to obtain that data, and they're not going to have a probable cause. And that, actually, someone just said a great point. I'm trying to sneak a peek over here and watch the comments. The cops were lazy. Now, obviously, I'm not too excited about that statement because I used to be a cop, but you're right. What I always say is cops take the path of least resistance. So if they can get this geofence data or cell tower or the tower dump information, and it leads to a suspect and a couple things match up, they're done. You know, a lot of times they won't continue their investigation or even talk to the individual to see what's going on. You know, maybe he's seeing somebody who lives next to the bank or where next to the murder scene. I used to constantly say, whenever the government would say, look, cell phone records show this individual at the area of the homicide at the time of the event. Well, that sounds bad. Then you find out he lived three houses down. It's always going to show him in the area of the homicide because that's his hood. That's where he hangs out. So there's more to all this information. And the problem is when you get this generic information, there's a lot of damage. You can ruin a lot of lives with this information. And then at the end, they're like, oh, you know what? I was wrong. Sorry about that. Sorry about ruining your life and making you get, you know, $100,000 worth of legal defense. You know, but, you know, we then finally figured out that you had nothing to do with this. So you have the FBI that now has all of this information on January 6th, and they have tons of information on individuals that did nothing wrong. They went there and they exercised their freedom of speech rights to protest, and now they're getting caught up in this stuff, and all of their personal information is now sitting out on an FBI server that's being maintained by a third-party vendor who won a contract bid. How do we feel about that? So here's the other problem that drives me crazy is right now you have Congress, if you want to call it Pelosi's Congress, if you want to call it that, has created this commission. Whenever you create a commission, the U.S., the citizens of the U.S. have to be confident that this committee is being set up in a nonpartisan way to get to the truth. So you have Nancy Pelosi who wants to put this together. So it's already suspect. And then she tells the Republicans, all right, give me some names. You know, we're going to have so many. We're going to make sure we have more than you, but give us some names of some people you want on this commission. And they do. They provide them, I believe, with five names. And Pelosi's like, okay, no to that one, no to this one. And of course, someone like Jim Jordan, you know, they're not going to let on this commission because the guy's incredible. I love watching this guy. During these hearings, when he's just drilling people, you know, there's certain people, senators and congressmen, that we just love to watch them question individuals because they make them look silly and they get to the point. And Jim Jordan's one of those that I love to watch. There's no way we could let him on this commission. So once you lose the confidence, once you start cherry picking, Nancy Pelosi starts cherry picking who she wants on this commission, we lose all confidence. And of course, the whole process falls down. And then Nancy Pelosi picks two Republicans to sit on this commission who are obvious Trump haters. I mean, there's probably no one that hates Trump more than Liz Cheney, but yet you're going to put her on this commission. There's no, you're not, there's so much conflict of interest that it's just unbelievable. If somebody just absolutely hate someone, would you really put them on a jury? So, that, I mean, that's really what they did. They took someone who said, I hate Donald Trump. I think he's the worst thing for this country. Okay, we want you to sit on the jury. I mean, that's just insane. So we have no confidence in the process whatsoever. We know it's being politicized at this point. And now they start handing out all these subpoenas. And this is ultimately where all of this is getting down to for me is these subpoenas for information, for data, for records, for individuals, none of this is supported by probable cause. None. Zip, zero, nada. The Constitution is very clear that you cannot have a search warrant or a subpoena without being supported by probable cause. But that's for criminal investigations. Now, all of a sudden, Congress, and this has actually kind of been ruled, and I'm kind of diving into this, but I'm not a constitutional expert. So what happens is you have the FBI go out and obtain all this generic data using kind of these generic warrants. You store it, then you hire this third-party company to organize it for you, and then Congress comes in later under the power of the Democrats, under Nancy Pelosi, and demands all those records with no probable cause. There's no criminal investigation. There's no, you know, individuals that are not being investigated for any crime whatsoever. All of a sudden, we start hearing their stuff in congressional hearings, now, which also brings up another point, is secrecy. Whenever you have a criminal investigation, it's very important that you maintain the integrity of the investigation. I worked on the Tom Clements homicide as part of the investigation team. We knew there was individuals that were leaking information to the media, and we knew who some of these people were. So we cut them out and said, you know what, we're not going to give you this kind of information anymore. And they got mad because they love being that link to the media. We knew the governor's office was leaking stuff, and there was others. So that's kind of some of the interesting things about Congress is, do we not think that they're not trying to look at all this data for political payback, which is exactly what they're trying to do right now? There's so much interesting stuff that's going on right now when it comes to Congress and this commission. I'm really not even that interested into what they come up with. I mean, if they happen to come up with something that's enlightening, then great, show it to me, show me the facts, and let's look at the facts. But when they start reading text messages between commentators on Fox News and saying, aha, there is a conspiracy, you know, between the two, and it's like, guys, stop. You know, what are they saying? You know, what are they actually communicating? Do you not think that the chief of staff or someone's not communicating with the media? You know, that they don't have each other's cell phone numbers? I've got on my cell phone number, I used to be a detective, I've probably got 30 to 40 reporters' cell phone numbers still on my cell phone that I could call up at any time I want, but I don't. So those connections are out there, you know, where they communicate things like, hey, would you be willing to do an interview? Things like that. So I'm not surprised at all that they're communicating with each other, but they're trying to, but the point is you have congressmen, I mean, Liz Cheney, for one, who's a Republican, a rhino by heart, we know this, who's trying to just wipe out as best she can Donald Trump before she's gone. And she thinks that she's showing some kind of investigative skills, that they found something super secretive. But the key is there's no secrets. So once you get caught up in all of this wide net of collection of data by the government, now we have to worry about Congress writing subpoenas with not based on probable cause, which is against the Constitution, obtaining all this information and then leaking it during a congressional hearing, talking about whatever. Do you think if they found out that one of these individuals working on Trump's administration was having an affair or something like that, that wouldn't get out? You know it would. So this is all just, it's all a political process. I'm very interested in seeing what happens next year with Steve Bannon and with Mark Meadows and others, that this whole contempt of Congress business, that now finally the Democrats say they're going to finally enforce this stuff. What does that mean? You know, do you really want these individuals talking in open court about certain things? I think it's going to be real interesting to see what's going to happen. And I think it's going to backfire on the Democrats. I think they're, you know, if we're still talking about this stuff next summer during campaign season, during the midterms, I think people are going to be fed up with that, and they're not going to want to hear about that crap. They want to have confidence in their government. And right now, people have zero confidence, you know, and they're talking about, oh, the shelves. I remember listening, kind of all going back to the whole beginning of this, Jen Psaki talking about the shelves are filled with stuff. I went over to a Kohl's here close by, and they're trying to spread things out so it looks like the shelves. But when you really look at it, what used to be packed with stuff is hardly filling the shelves. So we do have some serious issues going on, and people aren't going to want to hear about all this stupid stuff about January 6th. They're going to know, what are you doing for us? So I wanted to get everyone to understand and kind of get the background on these whole geofences and tower dumps and cell phone and social media, understand all the data that they're obtaining through social media. So I kind of wanted to throw that out there. I've been trying to notice some of the comments and stuff. We're going to completely change this up. They told me that John St. Augustine kind of knocked on about 5 minutes ago. So it's 3:30 right now. Perfect timing to switch over. So, Thomas, if you could bring in John St. Augustine. And for those of you who haven't met John St. Augustine, there he is. We can see him. How's it going, John? He used to be my boss. He used to be the commander of investigations at the El Paso County Sheriff's Office. He's been retained in the past, and I've told you guys this before, to work on private cases. He was brought in for the Lacey Peterson homicide out in California. The Canadian Royal Mounties have brought him in to train and all kinds of stuff. He travels all over the place. Recently, he was on Dr. Oz talking about, I can't even remember what that one was all about. Was that about JonBenet again, or was that?
It was
about JonBenet. So, you know, if we talk about this other stuff, they're all going to say, well, you're making me wait for the whole JonBenet conversation. And let me get rid of my background here. I want to get my background back to something that makes a little more sense for me. There we go.
Oh,
that's the one I like. I know you don't like the politics, but
yeah,
hey,
I hate the politics.
It's me. So let's talk a little bit about the background. I'm just going to turn you loose to talk about the background of JonBenet. But one of the things that a lot of people, well, how you got involved is you were the inspector at the El Paso County Sheriff's Office. You knew Lou Smith, who is widely known, unfortunately passed away a few years ago, as an investigator. He worked for Colorado Springs Police Department, and he was retained. So you were brought in to look at some of this stuff from the family on JonBenet's death, homicide. So why don't you talk about some background, and then we'll talk about what just was announced this week.
Sure. So actually, it was way before that, Mark. Back in actually December of 96, when the whole thing went down, I had just completed some training for Boulder PD, had met with them on another unrelated murder that they had. And I actually got a page, I'm dating myself a little bit here, but I actually on my beeper was asked to call Commander Eller, who was the commander of investigations back in 1996. I initially went in, talked with the Boulder staff, some of their investigators, their commander. At the time, it was a guy by the name of Chief Colby, who was the chief of Boulder PD. It was obvious at that time that they were pretty focused on the family. And, you know, so my thing was, okay, you know, what evidence do you have to support this? And basically they said, look, we're not asking you to solve it. We just wanted you to help us organize our evidence and present it. Well, fast forward about a year, Lou Smith gets involved with it with Alex Hunter. So actually it wasn't even a year. It was probably a few months later in 97. Lou gets involved in it. At the time, I was employed by the sheriff's office in Colorado Springs. And Lou says, hey, can you help me kind of put all of this evidence together? And, you know, there's really two theories in this. There's an intruder theory, and then obviously that the parents did it. And so I got involved in it, started to put things together, had exposure to all the evidence in the case, and then found a lot of really good evidence to support the intruder theory, which has been, you know, really ignored over the years. I think, you know, if you look at the case as a whole, the focus has really been on the family. And part of it is, you know, I think the media has really, you know, driven that in a lot of ways, right? Just to give you an example of one thing, you know, what was widely reported in 96 was that there was a lack of footwear impressions in the snow. I don't know if you remember that, Mark, but
I do.
It seemed to be a big thing, right? That if there's no shoe wear impressions in the snow, it had to have been done by somebody inside of the home. Well, what we find out is that there was actually no snow outside of the home. So there was no footwear impressions in the snow because there was no snow on the ground. But the media was able to run with that. And so there was immediately, right, this focus on the family. And that focus really has been going on for now, what, 25 years. There's still, a wide number of people that have opinions that the family did it. Of course, you and I, coming from a law enforcement background, it's extremely important that you don't focus on, emotions, and that you rely on evidence, right? And so one of the main things that really troubled me as I was going through the case, and again, having exposure to all the evidence in the case, one of the big things is that, she was stun gunned. I don't think there's any disputing that. There's been forensic pathologists, in particular, Dr. Doberson, who's here in Colorado, had an opportunity to look at the case. Dr. Kelly, right here in El Paso County, has had an opportunity to look at the case. And I don't think there's any disputing that there's stun gun marks, not only on her face, but on her back. What also is important to note is that there was a garrote that was placed around her neck. And actually, the cause of death is strangulation, and the manner of death is homicide. What also is important to note is that she was sexually assaulted, that there was some tearing to her vaginal vault, and also that there was foreign DNA. And this is probably the biggest thing for me as an investigator, is when you find out that there's foreign DNA, not only under her fingernails, but on her long johns that were tested in, I believe, 2006, 2008 timeframe. And there was also DNA on her underwear, all of which comes from the same source, of which none of that comes or matches with anybody in the family. Not her brother Burke, not her mom Patsy, not her father, John Ramsey, nor her brother John Andrew. So when all of this evidence is looked at in its totality, right, one has to ask ourselves, for the last 2.5 decades, why have we only been focusing on the family? And that's been pretty much, what the focus has been by law enforcement, is strictly on the family. And when you look at a homicide, one of the most dangerous things you can do is to have that tunnel vision, right? That just lose your objectivity and just be so focused on who you believe did it based on really no evidence. I mean, the evidence they have is that they weren't acting right after the murder. Well, I mean, I'm not sure how you're supposed to act after your 6-year-old daughter has been murdered. I can tell you, if my daughter at the time, at any time, is murdered, you're not going to find a normal John St. Augustine, even in lieu of me being in law enforcement, for many years and, working cases for the better part of almost 3 decades. This is not, there's no textbook of how you should act. As far as other evidence, what you have to ask yourself is, okay, so there's fibers from mom on her. Okay, so what? There's a principle, right? A thing called Locard's principle, the transfer theory. Somebody will always take something and leave something behind. But in this particular case, the fact that they live together, how abnormal is it really to have fibers from either mom or dad or brother on JonBenet? That's it, we're talking Christmas. So there's probably a lot of hugging going on, right? There's a lot of transferring going on. What can't be ignored are those things that I was talking about before, right? So, where did this garrote, how was it manufactured? Where is this missing piece of the paintbrush? The stun gun, where is this stun gun? Why would you stun gun your daughter multiple times and then garrote her? And then, oh, by the way, the big thing was the coup de grace, a blow to her head over 2 occipital lobes, equivalent of a 70-mile-an-hour automobile crash, right? So you got to look at all the evidence altogether in its totality. And you can't just pick and choose, the pieces that you want to use. This is a jigsaw puzzle. And what you have to do is you have to put all the pieces together. And once you put all the pieces together, it starts to frame where your investigation should go. And what I will tell you is, the last 25 years, there really hasn't been any objectiveness done by law enforcement, unfortunately, to really seek out who's been responsible for this murder. I mean, this is a case that happened right when DNA was somewhat in its infancy in this country as a tool for law enforcement. But what we do know is that there are cases that are 3-4 decades old. I mean, just look at what happened in California recently involving that former police officer, D'Angelo, called the Golden State Killer. He was caught from DNA that they were able to compare to cases 3-4 decades ago. And yet all we've done really in the JonBenet Ramsey case is focus on the family. And that is dangerous, especially when you're in law enforcement. And, you know, as an investigator, right, you and I, Mark, we just talked about this the other day when we testified in a hearing on Wednesday, right? An investigator gathers facts. That's all we do. We don't draw opinions. You know, we allow the facts to kind of drive our opinions, right? But we rely on facts, right? We don't say, hey, they're not acting right, so they must be guilty, or they didn't do this, so they must be guilty. It's what evidence do we have to support that someone in the family did it? And the interesting thing to note, and I just want to kind of give this, you know, back in the, I think it was 2008, 2010, a Georgia judge ruled after reviewing all the evidence and all the different pieces of this case that judge had access to, that the family was exonerated by a judge in Georgia. But yet here we are 25 years, tomorrow night, Sunday morning, right, is when this murder happened. And I will tell you, the vast majority of people, especially people currently in law enforcement, still believe that the family has something to do with it. And you know, we have to be cautious about that, because again, it's very dangerous to pick and choose things that you think make them guilty, or make you think that they're guilty of it, and then ignore important pieces like the stun gun, like the blow to her head, like the garrote, like the DNA, the foreign DNA on her long johns, under her fingernails, and on her underwear, that all come from the same source.
So is there a lot of evidence that they still have that could be tested today,
Mark,
for DNA type evidence?
Tons. So, you know, let me tell you what I do know. And again, I had access to every piece of evidence in this case. And I will tell you, there was probably upwards of 1,000 items that were collected in the days and weeks and months after the murder of JonBenet. And what happened was law enforcement just picked and choose the things that they thought may come back to mom or dad or brother. And when that evidence did not link up with them, right, it was exculpatory, they kind of stopped testing the items. So there's a number of items and evidence that have never been tested. And, you know, part of the problem that, you know, we're dealing with is that a lot of who's in leadership right now in Boulder, and you know me, right, I'm not anti-law enforcement. I was in law enforcement. You and I have been in it, right, you know, for a number of years, right, almost 2 decades. And I will tell you that it's not that I'm anti-law enforcement. I'm anti not seeking the truth. That's the problem in this case, is that nobody is proactively wanting to get to the bottom of what happened to that little girl. And so those individuals who were patrol officers and detectives are now commanders and deputy chiefs who can dictate really the way this case can be investigated from here on out. And that is very dangerous, right? What would be the safe thing to do is turn it over to an independent law enforcement agency, right? Like the Attorney General's office, or get somebody within the Denver metro area that has no ties to the investigation to go back and go over everything and look at the case really from the start to where we are today, so that you don't lose that objectivity, right? What has been lost over 25 years is that the cops who were there 25 years ago have always thought the family has been responsible for it. So they continue to have that mindset. And that is extremely dangerous. The mindset should be, what does this evidence reveal? What is it telling us? So when you ask me, are there evidence items that need to be tested? A lot of evidence items. I would venture to guess there are probably upwards of 500 to 800 items that have never been tested. Never been tested. How can that be? Never been tested.
Right.
You have to go back and we have to look at this and test. I'm not saying that all 1,000 items need to be tested, but there has to be somebody to go through it with an objective mind and go, what is going to be our best chance of potentially acquiring DNA from the items that were collected back on December 26th of 1996?
Yeah, exactly. So I know they never found a stun gun in the house, right, when they searched the house.
Right.
Now, they did actually find a stun gun in another investigation. did they ever try to match that stun gun up?
Well, yeah, that was one of Dr. Doberson's big tests in this case, was that he actually got an air taser and a cattle prod, and he was actually able to show that the air taser and a cattle prod would actually create that diameter of the injuries that we see on JonBenet's face. So there was an injury to her, I believe it was her right cheek, and there was an injury to her back, of which both of those injuries are consistent. And what a forensic pathologist is saying is that it's coming from either a cattle prod or an air taser. That's not coming from train tracks that has been reported, you know, in the past, that this is actually burn marks from either a taser, an air taser, or a cattle prod.
Right. And, you know, like you had started off in saying that they had made the statement there was no evidence of an intruder, mm-hmm. but yet, I mean, would you say that there actually is evidence of mm-hmm. intruder?
Yes, lots of good evidence that there's an intruder. Just some examples of that. A door was ajar on the backside of the property. And again, remember, this is a 6,700 square feet Tudor. Back door was ajar when law enforcement initially responded. The downstairs had a broken window with a luggage underneath it with a scuff mark along the back of the wall. The luggage had broken glass on it. The luggage itself inside of it had a duvet and a Dr. Seuss book. But what was important to note is that the fibers found inside the suitcase matched JonBenet's fibers of which she was found, of where the clothing that she was wearing when she's found by her dad. So, you know, we have that and, you know, obviously the note has been looked at by experts, but the experts that you have to pay attention to are the people who have done this for a number of years. You know, you got to be very careful with handwriting exemplars because it's not medical certainty, right? It's not like DNA.
Right.
And so it's much like polygraphy, right? And what these experts are saying is that the writing on that note, right, this 2.5-page ransom note did not come from mom, did not come from dad, did not come from brother Burke or John Andrews. So where did this note come from, right? Where did it come from? Why is this note in there? And, you know, people will say, well, it makes reference to $118,000 in the ransom note. Well, if you would have been in the John Ramsey's office, you would know that his bonus for 1996 was approximately $118,000. So it's again, right, you're taking bits and pieces of things and you're trying to make it fit the story rather than looking at the real physical evidence in this case, right? The DNA under her fingernails, on her long johns, right, on her underwear, the fact that she was sexually assaulted, that there's a piece of a paintbrush that's missing. But what's interesting, Mark, is that in the autopsy, it actually says that there are wood shards in her vaginal vault, consistent with somebody driving this paintbrush into her vaginal vault, which is what left those wood shards behind. Yet there's a piece of that brush missing, which is, if you're in our line of work, it's consistent with a pedophile, right? Taking a trophy.
The treasure.
Yeah, the treasure, exactly, right? In our, you know, we've seen it a lot of times. Typically, it's underwear, right? It's something, some form of that.
Right.
But in this case, we have a paintbrush that's been broken in at least three parts. Two pieces are found and one's not. Where is that? Where is the stun gun? Where is the rope that was used to strangle her? Where's, you know, all these items? Where's whose DNA is this? That's the biggest question.
Right.
Whose DNA is this? But yet, you know, you and I talked about this just earlier when I was driving back from work today, right? Now, all of a sudden, you're going to test this stuff 25 years later? Like now what? Now, all of a sudden, it's important 25 years later? Where was this effort back in the 90s and 2000s when DNA, right, was testing was available to us? But now you're going to go back and retest things and make it look now like you're doing something 25 years later. I mean, I think it's a bunch of hogwash personally. I think this is just an attempt to be, hey, we're being responsible investigators, but are you really truly being responsible? Because you haven't done anything for the better part of at least 15, 20 years.
Right. So is it kind of your opinion that if the right person was looking into this, or the right people, that we're not looking at it with a bias, but we're just trying to solve this case, that there's a good chance through DNA and some of the more modern techniques that something could be revealed in this case, even 25 years later?
Absolutely. I mean, like I was telling you about the D'Angelo case, that was DNA. I mean, look at Phil Rader in the BTK. What they did was they took his daughter's DNA And you know, in D'Angelo, right. I believe it was 23andMe. They were able to find some kind of hint, right, using the genetics of DNA and some of these platforms like 23andMe, to where you can, you know, go out there and you have a profile of yourself, and they're going, wait, this DNA matches somebody from within 23andMe. I mean, CODIS, right, is the APHIS, right? APHIS, for those of you listening, is what we use for fingerprints. CODIS, the Combined DNA Index System, is what we use for DNA. And the reality is that CODIS more than likely can solve this case. The question is whether or not that DNA is in the system. And then more importantly, are we testing the items from back in during the time of the murder to see if we have some kind of DNA profile that we can develop from those items?
Interesting. I'm sure we're going to be able to talk more about JonBenet, because I personally feel that, I mean, this is just my opinion at this point, that how coincidental, you know, on the 25-year anniversary, that they come out and say, yeah, there's some other things that we're looking at. It's still an active case. And, it, you know, the bottom line is, if it's really an active case, get on it and start working it. They'll probably just drop it again after the first of the year and nothing will happen again.
Right. Get the FBI involved. You know, get the feds have great labs throughout, you know, that they have access to. Get some of these commercial labs that are all law enforcement friendly. Send these items out there. Let them develop some DNA profiles. And you may find out that it's a DNA profile. I mean, here's the thing. If any of that DNA matches anything on her, from her underwear, her long johns, or her fingernails, guess what? In our line of work, that's called a clue. You don't need to be Sherlock Holmes, right? We would be able to use that potentially to at least further our investigation or their investigation to maybe come to a resolution in this case. This is a very solvable case.
Right, exactly. So I know we're kind of getting close to the end, and we'll try. We'll see if Chuck and Julie let me guest host next year, and there might be some other things coming up that we might announce. Who knows? And we can talk about some other stuff. I really want to kind of talk about, we don't have time, so I'm just going to bring this up. I would like to have talked about Kim Potter. And we know that she was found guilty of everything. The only thing I'll say about that real quick is I don't think that's over. I think there's probably some more stuff that's going to come up with that. I wanted to talk about the truck driver sentenced to 110 years. They're telling me we still have 5 minutes. So here, just real quick, kind of the three things that I just wanted to touch on. Was about Kim Potter. I watched most of that trial. I will say this to kind of set up for maybe a future conversation in detail, is what she did is not the first thing. It's not the first time that's ever happened.
No.
They talk about weapon confusion and things like that. It happens. I would tell you, if I was still in law enforcement in this scenario and you know she's found guilty, I'd almost not want to carry a taser. You know, I'd be like, you know what? I don't want to have any, I don't even want to have the chance that I pull my gun and mistake it for the taser. Cause it's happened before and cops were not charged. People were killed and the cops weren't charged for that accident. So my view is if you're going to pull something that even resembles a handgun, it needs to be lethal force. And so just to get rid of that confusion. So, and we can talk about Kim Potter some more in the future. The Ethan Crumbly, I'm kind of skipping the truck driver up in Michigan. That really interests me that they're charging the parents, and we're getting more and more information, and we'll probably get even more. You know, if you know that your son has some issues and you go out and buy a handgun and let them have access to it, that's just kind of, that concerns me as well. I don't know if you have any thoughts about Kim Potter or Ethan Crumbly up in Michigan.
You know, Kim Potter, I mean, it's a tragedy any way you look at it, Mark. I mean, I don't know a lot about the details. I had a chance to kind of look over, you know, part of that video when the vehicle stop happened. I will tell you, her actions are consistent with one, you know, if you recall, I mean, when we were cops, right, when we did taser training, the number one thing they tell you when you're deploying a taser is to say what? Taser, right?
Yep.
She says that. So it's not as if, you know, I think what you have is potentially a training scar. I mean, if you really look at how we train with tasers, you'll find that law enforcement really doesn't do a lot of training with their tasers. It's simply point it at something, deploy it, and see if, you know, the cartridge, you know, goes out and does its thing. But do you really You know, do you do any kind of scenario based training, right? That reality based training where you have situations where do you use a taser or do you use your deadly, you know, deadly force? I think the thing that we need to look at in that case, right, for those of you who are listening, you know, things like Tennessee v. Garner, right? Graham v. Connor, right? Those are two significant cases, right? And it's all about objective reasonableness. And obviously the jury saw, you know, a certain way.
Saw it differently.
Yeah, you've got to respect, obviously, their decision. But I will tell you, you know, those are the two things I would say, you know, you have to really look at is Graham v. Connor, right? Yep. What does an officer do? Not in hindsight, not in hindsight 2020, but in the view of what was going on at that particular moment, what would a reasonable officer do, right? And obviously, she made a mistake because she thought she deployed her taser.
Right, and that's kind of the issue. We need to shut this down.
Okay.
But I mean, that's kind of, for me, is the issue is that she made a mistake, but we'll talk about that more, hopefully, going forward if we have some other ones coming up. But yes, it's Christmas Eve. What on earth Merry are Christmas. We doing on a podcast on Christmas Eve? Like I said, I'm going to be going straight up to the car and taking off as soon as this is over. But definitely, Merry Christmas and let's go, Brandon. No issues with that. Everyone have a glorious, wonderful Christmas with your family and a wonderful new year. And hopefully we'll have some time to talk some more during 2022. So Merry Christmas, everyone. We'll see everybody later.
Everybody. Happy New Year.
Thanks. All right.